From Florida to Oregon, Utah to Tennessee, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the federal budget is now running trillion-dollar annual deficits. How long can this continue, and what can be done to stem the flow of red ink? Gary Wolfram of Hillsdale College is here with the answers. Congress is considering a reauthorization of the Farm Bill, and a special election is on the horizon in Ohio. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on both. Are trade tariffs a good idea? To find out, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Brian Riley from the National Taxpayers Union. And unlike the private sector, government has no performance standards to determine whether or not a program is actually working. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. After the passing of this spring's omnibus spending bills, the federal government is facing trillion-dollar annual deficits for the foreseeable future. Here to talk about why that can't continue and what must be done to address the problem is Gary Wolfram. Gary is a professor of economics and public policy at Hillsdale College. Gary, welcome to American Radio Journal. Gary, we have a situation where Congress here a few weeks back passed an omnibus spending bill. It busted the budget. We're looking at trillion-dollar deficits. Before we get into what can be done to address these deficits, as an economist, how long can we keep up this rate of spending? When do we hit a wall where we simply can't borrow enough?
Well, that's a good question. Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations talked about in his chapter on debt that when you get to the point where people are no longer willing to buy your debt, that's when you have a problem. Because what we do is when a $1,000 Treasury bill comes due, we don't send out a check from Treasury. What we do is we sell another $1,000 bond and then pay back the old one. So as long as people keep buying our new debt as the old debt comes due, we're okay. But at some point, people may say, you know what, I just don't think that the federal government, the U.S. government's going to be able to pay me back in dollars that are worth anything near what the dollars are today, and that's when you'll have a problem.
As we look at the budget situation, and Congress, of course, recently, as I mentioned, they blew through all the sequester and all the spending limits that were put into place in the Obama administration. But even in the scope of what they have to deal with, the discretionary spending that they have available to them, even if they were to tighten their budget there, would that still get us out of a deficit mode?
Well, no. And that's sort of my point I'm trying to make is that if what you did was you did not pass any appropriation bill, if you just said, okay, Congress isn't showing up this year, we're not passing this omnibus bill, we're not passing what we should have been passing, which is 12 different appropriations bills, we're not passing anything, you would still spend $2.7 trillion in fiscal 2019. That means that you're going to be spending all but $390 billion of what's left over. So we could run a surplus of $390 billion if we paid the net interest on the debt and we paid for these mandatory spending programs. And what's interesting is if you look at the year 2028, like under the Congressional Budget Office, if you take the mandatory spending, which is basically Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and some veterans programs, it will be 98.5% of the revenue that the federal government takes in 2028, which means if you want to balance the budget, you've got to deal with these spending programs that are already mandated.
Let's talk now for a couple minutes about all these mandated spending programs, and perhaps the biggest, or at least one of the biggest, is Social Security. Congress, of course, politically, it would be difficult, if not disastrous, for Congress to try to start cutting those benefits. But, Gary, are we really at a point where Congress is going to have to tighten the belt in some way to either reduce benefits, raise retirement age? What can be done to put this system on a sustainable basis?
Well, Ronald Reagan was able to, he was the last president that was able to do anything about this. He ended up extending the retirement age a little bit. And it turns out for Social Security, you can do a substantial amount on the deficit by extending the retirement age. Now, probably what you'd have to do is you have to say, okay, for people, let's say over the age of 55, we're going to keep it the way it is. If you're under 55, you're going to have to save more on your own. You're not going to get as much, or you're going to have to wait later. And so that can be done probably more easily than dealing with Medicare. Medicare, what's going to have to happen is you're going to have to change the system, Medicare and Medicaid. I tell my students, when you take somebody out to dinner, when do you tell them you're picking up the tab? And the answer is after they've ordered. The way Medicare and Medicaid works is you know that I'm picking up your tab. You don't ask how much does that cost. In addition, they tell the waiter you're picking up the tab. So the waiter comes out with a $500 bottle of wine. Well, the equivalent is that if I'm in the healthcare business, my incentive is to produce very expensive things that will be paid for by Medicare, whether it actually does much good at all. And if you changed it the way the private sector did to health savings accounts and said, hey, we're going to pay a high deductible policy and you're going to get $2,000 or whatever, and then you can spend it on health services, you'll start to ask, oh, if I get that blood test done here, will it be less expensive than over here? And then you'll see a whole change in how healthcare is provided. You'll have like Walgreens or something will have a nurse practitioner in their pharmacy, and you'll walk in and they'll say, oh, your kid's got pink eye, that's $10, here's the prescription. So the whole thing would start to be driven the same way we produce other goods and services. When the person's paying for it, is the person that's receiving it, it will change the whole way that this is done.
Is anybody in Congress at all talking about any of these reforms?
A little bit. Actually, there's a guy named John Goodman. He was on the forefront of these health savings accounts when they did in the private sector. And he's got a little book called Priceless, which talks about how you might do this. And there are some folks that are doing it. I think that the fact that it has already happened in the private sector will give us an opportunity for it to happen in the public sector. But you're right, the Social Security, Medicare, anything that deals with people over 65 who tend to vote a lot, those things tend to be the third rail of politics. So it's going to take somebody out there that can be the great communicator and can explain, no, you're going to actually have better healthcare services at lower cost if we make these moves.
What about work requirements or public service requirements for folks to receive Medicaid assistance if they're able-bodied and able-minded? Would that start to make a dent in the deficit that we have?
It would make some dent. And in particular, it would make it more on the state side. That is, Medicaid is shared by the state government and the federal government. So federal government spending on Medicaid in 2019 is going to be about $400 billion. You would probably help out state governments who are finding that Medicaid expenditures are getting to be one of the largest costs in their budget. And to the extent that you can change people's incentives, then you can make some progress. But I would suspect it's going to help more on the state government end than the federal government end.
We have been talking with Gary Wolfram, who is a professor of economics and public policy at Hillsdale College. Gary, tell us a little bit about Hillsdale. Also, where can folks read your writings on this topic?
Well, Hillsdale is one of the few truly independent colleges. We are one of the highest-ranked colleges in terms of U.S. News and Report and Best Buy among Princeton Best Buys and et cetera. And it's sort of interesting that we not only don't take federal money, but our students can't take federal money, which means private donors have made up all of that difference. You can read my posts on Twitter. I'm at Gary_Wolfram. And if you want to check out Hillsdale in more detail, get on www.hillsdale.edu.
Gary Wolfram of Hillsdale College. Gary, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
At the Club for Growth, Andy Roth does us the favor every week of keeping an eye on not only what's happening in Congress, but what is happening politically all across the Fruited Plain. Andy, good to have you here.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
We are going to talk both policy and politics today, starting out with policy. The big item before Congress at the moment, Andy, is the Farm Bill. How big is it and why is it so important?
It's big. To be honest with you, I don't know the price tag, but I do know that 80% of it has nothing to do with farms. Back in the several decades ago, it was very clear that the rural part of the country supported the Farm Bill, and the urban areas of the country supported the food stamp program. And they realized that neither of those had the overall votes to pass. So they made an unholy alliance to combine those two things into one bill so that there would be rural and urban support for the overall product. This is the very definition of log rolling, which is not a very ethical thing to do, but it is what Congress does. So the Farm Bill this year, it gets reauthorized every 4 or 5 years, and it's due up this year. Because Congress is so dysfunctional, I don't think that a Farm Bill can pass, but that's not stopping House Republicans from bringing up the bill and trying to have a debate about it.
So we have this Farm Bill coming up, and as you've mentioned, they're really marrying two completely different areas. Is there any strategic effort on the part of conservatives to try to separate this back out so that you have one bill that deals with agricultural issues and then one bill that deals with food stamp and other such issues?
Yeah, I mean, this really shouldn't be a conservative fight. This should be a government reform, good policy fight, or a good government fight. You should have a single bill discuss a single program, and its merits should be voted on up or down, and then move on to the next one. The last time the Farm Bill came up, we, as movement, as a conservative movement, successfully split the bill up. We told leadership that we weren't going to support a bill that had the two programs in it. And so they didn't have the votes because of that, so they split the bills up. This was in the House. We successfully split the bills up. We had a vote on each. They unfortunately still passed. They went to the Senate, where the Senate remarried them, and then both chambers ultimately passed it. But the fight was worth having, even though we lost. And so going forward, we need to maintain that position that the bill needs to be split up. And right now, leadership is not interested in doing that. What they're trying to do is pass a bill that has very little reforms in it. It maintains the status quo almost largely complete, and then they're hoping that Democrats will oppose it, and then they'll somehow use it as a political weapon to whack Democrats in rural districts for opposing the Farm Bill. So this is a political exercise, I think, and not a policy reform issue. It would be my hope that with Trump in the White House and with Republicans in control of Congress, that we could actually push for some really strong reforms in both programs, vote on them separately, and see what happens. But that's definitely not the case here.
Is there any movement on the long effort to try to add some work and or public service requirements for those who receive food stamps?
The current Republican bill does have some work requirements in it, but there are gaping loopholes in it that makes it almost untenable. So that's very unfortunate.
Let's shift gears a bit here now and talk about the Buckeye State, where there is going to be a special congressional election. These have thus far been held on the Republican side of the playing field. Andy, what's happening in Ohio?
Yeah, we have a classic conservative versus establishment race here. There are several candidates running, actually, but the leading candidate, I suppose you could call him the leading candidate, although we haven't seen any recent polling, is a state senator named Troy Balderson. He is fully backed by the establishment. He has voted to block Medicaid expansion, but then changed his mind and voted to expand Medicaid when Governor Kasich unilaterally expanded it himself. He is backed by the former congressman in this district, Pat Teaberry, who is a very moderate member. And so all of the planets are aligning behind him to drag him over the finish line. It should be noted that there are some outside groups that are coming in behind Balderson. So it's very clear that the establishment wants him to win. Then on the other side, there's a conservative, Melanie Lenihan. She's a township trustee. She's endorsed by the House Freedom Caucus. She's very conservative. She's very much supportive of pushing the president's agenda. Then there is Tim Kaine, who is former policy scholar from the Heritage Foundation, that conservative think tank here in Washington, D.C. Columbus is his hometown. That's where this district is. And then there are a few other candidates. But the Club for Growth PAC, the group that I work for, we like both Melanie and Tim Kaine. And so rather than endorse someone in this race, we have just decided to educate voters about Balderson's liberal record, particularly on Medicaid expansion. So our hope is that we can turn voters off on him, and hopefully Melanie or Tim can reach the finish line first.
We will continue to keep an eye on that, and we have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again.
Thanks, Loman.
Tariffs on steel and aluminum and possibly other products are on the horizon. To discuss the wisdom of such action, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Brian Riley, who is director of the National Taxpayer Union's Free Trade Initiative. Eric?
We continue to wait for a final answer from the White House on whether it will impose major tariffs on some important U.S. trading partners like Canada, Mexico, and the EU. But in the meantime, groups like the National Taxpayers Union are getting together to push back against the idea that tariffs are necessary to protect the American economy. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Brian Riley. He's the director of the brand new Free Trade Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union, and he joins us now to talk about Trump, these tariffs, and a letter that the NTU, along with more than 1,000 economists from across the political spectrum, are sending to the White House this week. Brian, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show with us.
Thank you.
Now, before we get into what your group and some of the others are doing this week with regard to these tariffs and pushing back against them, let's talk a little bit about the news, or maybe lack thereof, out of the White House on Monday. Trump, all the way back in March, he announced that there were going to be 25% tariffs on steel and 10% tariffs on aluminum, but he granted exemptions, temporary ones, to a handful of major U.S. allies and trading partners. Included in that group was Canada and Mexico, along with the EU, Brazil, Argentina, a few others. Those temporary exemptions were set to expire on Monday of this past week, but the White House, just a couple hours before that, decided to extend them until June 1st. So what does all that mean?
Well, nobody really knows what it means. There was initially a time frame before the tariffs were set to go into effect. That has been bumped back as the administration tries to negotiate some deals with our trading partners. So I guess the good news is we don't have across-the-board tariffs of 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, as was initially suggested. So that's good news, especially if you're somebody who, say, works for a car maker or in the construction industry or buys goods containing aluminum or steel, which is almost all of us. The bad news, though, I think, is that this gives the government some additional discretionary power to pick winners and losers, both among our trading partners. Well, Canada, you'll get a temporary exemption if you sign on to what we want on NAFTA. And Japan, you won't get an exemption. And also to pick winners and losers among Americans. So if you're a steel-using industry and you think that the use of this is no threat to national security, which is the basis for these tariffs, you have to fill out a form and hope the Commerce Department approves it and hope the steel industry doesn't object. And it's a long, complicated process, and odds are you're going to have to hire a lawyer or a lobbyist in D.C. to help you get through this process. So it's a new paperwork burden on businesses that use steel and aluminum, and it's just something that really is a direct contrast to the idea of an administration coming in saying, we're going to cut taxes, we're going to cut regulations. Well, that's certainly not the case with respect to steel and aluminum.
Yeah, look, conservatives, Republicans, business people, whatever basket you want to put everybody in on the right side of the political spectrum. I think if this was a Democratic administration that was imposing new taxes on businesses that use steel, for example, and maybe they would say this is because they're polluting or something and they have to pay more to make up for that. This is a little more hidden than that, but the consequences are really kind of the same. You're increasing the costs that businesses have to bear, especially businesses that need to use steel or aluminum. Tariffs are just taxes, and they're taxes that are ultimately paid by American businesses and consumers. And this is, as you said, Brian, it is the government picking winners and losers in the economy, which is something that you would think people on the right would, they would be really upset about that if it wasn't a Republican administration in the White House, maybe. We're talking with Brian Riley from the National Taxpayers Union, and Brian, NTU is part of several groups that are launching a new effort this week to change the White House's mind on these tariffs. Tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing.
Well, the kinds of things that you and I are talking about are not particularly controversial. And so we're reading a letter to President Trump and to Congress from economists across the country. We have over 1,000 economists from every state who signed on, pointing out the damage that these tariffs could cause to the U.S. economy. These principles are pretty timeless.
Look, the rules of economics are, at the end of the day, a lot like physics, right? I mean, you might have someone tell you that gravity isn't real and it's just magic that keeps us all down here on the ground and not flying up into the air. But there are real rules that govern economics. We know how this stuff works.
I think that reminds me of just a few weeks ago, we had somebody try and launch himself in a homemade rocket to prove that the Earth was flat. Now, that's no particularly harm in that, but imagine if he was running NASA. That's something that I would be concerned about. And with respect to economics, I don't think we want to have flat earth economic policy, flat earth theories driving our trade policy. And that's why so many economists have been willing to sign on. And there are advisors to presidents ranging from Ronald Reagan to Barack Obama. So this is not a partisan, politically driven issue. It's just a very broad-based agreement among economists. This is just one of the things, like you said, it's like physicists understanding that gravity exists. I think in economics and trade policy, I can kind of understand how if you're a businessman and you hear somebody talk about a trade deficit, it's easy to say deficit, that sounds bad, we better do something about it. And it's really important for those who understand a little bit more how things work that a trade deficit does not mean we owe anybody anything, and to really try and explain that takes some effort. So that's what we're hoping to accomplish with this letter, is to make sure that the administration and Congress are getting good advice and understand that this is among people who understand economics, this isn't a particularly controversial idea at all.
And more than 1,000 economists, as you said, Brian, across the political spectrum. The letter is signed by advisors to both Democratic and Republican presidential administrations, along with some Nobel Prize winners. As some others like to say about a totally different topic, Brian, the science is settled on this. The science is settled. We know how tariffs affect the economy. But that is unfortunately all the time that we have to talk about this today. Brian, thanks for taking some time and being here with us.
Thank you.
And again, that's Brian Riley from the National Taxpayers Union. He is the director of their Free Trade Initiative. You can check out more of their work and read the letter that they are sending to the Trump White House at ntu.org. And you can continue to follow our coverage of tariffs and free trade at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Government programs often produce more smoke and mirrors than results. Here to talk about the consequences of such actions is Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, with this week's American Radio Journal commentary.
Having spent the past year in the legislature as a state representative, I'm continuously amazed by the lack of critical analysis in government. As an aside, I came out of the private sector and am a CPA who owned my own turnaround management practice. Our firm succeeded or failed based upon my decisions. When government fails, however, citizens pay. Government is seldom accountable for its failures or its lack of planning. I've seen politicians run on a platform of fixing the very problems that they created. Amazing. The methodology used to develop governmental programs is suspect at best. Spending by the executive branch is seldom based upon results, and it's frequently based upon hearsay and innuendo. For example, Social Security, which is failing, is now called an entitlement when, in fact, all contributions came from taxpayers and employers. Citizens with significant wealth have been made to believe that they have to justify why they should receive Social Security since they allegedly do not need it, which is an entitlement mentality. The smoke and mirrors surrounding Social Security have confused people about the nature of what they earned. Despite hoopla from the government is merely a trustee of the Social Security trust funds. The marketing of government programs has also frequently clouded the landscape about what is real and what is not, based solely upon the whim and fancy of those in office. Common Core has been touted as the newest brainchild for improving education for all. prior to Common Core, it was No Child Left Behind. Meanwhile, many employers and most students express concern about students who are entering the workforce with little or no preparation for the real world. In other words, it became almost all children left behind. Smoke and mirrors. The difficulty of both the education system and Social Security examples is that government lacks any meaningful measure of effectiveness about the effectiveness of its programs. Feeling good replaces actual results. Government has no competition and has no performance standards to evaluate the efficacy of programs other than the people served and the Constitution. Businesses and individuals are judged by the marketplace. Businesses and individuals adapt or they face obsolescence and potential bankruptcy. Government perpetuates itself by developing a keenly honed inability to adopt a performance measure or performance measures which may indicate that they are failing. Government can go bankrupt, but a bankrupt government is replaced by another bankrupt government. For instance, former President Obama and former Vice President Joe Biden made the comment during the 2008 stock market collapse that it was fortunate that Social Security was not invested in the market. The smoke and mirrors of their argument was seldom countered, even though most experts concluded that they were wrong. In effect, there are no performance measure against which Social Security is measured, and therefore arguments against it are generally one-sided, self-serving arguments designed to perpetuate the status quo rather than serve the people. Suboptimal decisions are forced then on the most vulnerable. The lack of critical and analytical analyses in developing political solutions to societal problems have perpetuated greater pain and unintended consequences on our society at almost every turn. Be it the opioid crisis, the student debt crisis, the autism epidemic, exploding medical costs, national obesity, global warming, or virtually every government program, the root causes and potential solutions are seldom well thought out. The need for scientific review and analysis is now more important than ever because so many government programs are in danger of failing catastrophically. The critical risk factors facing the government as smoke and mirrors explodes in virtually every facet of the economy. Greater analytical thought is required to prevent system failures as well as systemic failures of entire segments of the economy. To effectively combat the smoke and mirrors, every program in any government should be evaluated against the performance metric that has been analyzed and scrutinized to avoid unintended consequences. Those measures should be incorporated into any major piece of legislation that is passed. An Auditor General, Office of Inspector General, or Office of Management and Budget at the federal level should be an independent agency that reviews for the legislature and the executive branch the viability of the programs implemented. Any agency or program which fails this performance metric system must be subject to review. This review and resulting recommendations for improvement would then be subjected to legislative correction. This concept appears simplistic, but I believe it is the part of the reason why the Founding Fathers significantly limited what government would be involved in. As our government expanded its reach, the difficulty of determining whether or not such expansion was effective or not was lost. Our nation has severe problems. They can be solved. The smoke and mirrors used by government to justify its own existence threatens our existence. Without meaningful systems of controls on the programs will likely lead to disaster and great harm to citizens due to the unintended consequences of a governmental program run amok. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWOS-FM in Orangeburg, South Carolina, WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.